Thank you very much for coming to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the professional committee of the club. My name is Keith Bradshaw. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host today. Before I introduce our speaker, just two housekeeping notes. First, everybody, please turn off your cell phones now, or at least put them on mute. We have a lot of television cameras. We don't want to lose a good comment as somebody's phone rings. So please, all of you, check your phones now and make sure that they're off. Next, just a brief mention, we have another speaker coming up next Monday. It will be a live drone demonstration. For those of you interested in what has become not only the latest military technology, but also the latest journalism technology. I remember the BBC was using one in Tacloban, and we were all enviously looking how they could get these aerial views of the damage from Typhoon Haiyan. So we're going to have a demonstration of that right here in the main dining room next Monday. With that, not flying around the main dining room. With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. Mrs. Chan, as all of you know, was the Chief Secretary of Hong Kong and the head of the civil service both before and after the handover. She's also somebody who's inspiring to talk to. We were just talking about leadership and how to develop leaders, a subject on which she has many strong ideas and developed many leaders when she was running the Hong Kong Civil Service. Yesterday, she participated in the march. She was walking for the ninth consecutive time, the largest march that she'd seen. She wasn't there in 2003. And she's here today to tell us about what she sees as the winding path forward for universal suffrage. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back at the FCC. It's almost exactly 8 years since I last spoke here, when I decided to adopt a higher profile in terms of governance issues and particularly on pushing forward on constitutional reforms. Since then, myself and a band of faithful colleagues have found ourselves down an increasingly long and tortuous road towards universal suffrage. At times, we feel that we're caught in a maze with many dead ends. But I think I'm speaking on behalf of all my colleagues when I say that throughout all this, we've never given up hope. We continue to believe, and we have to believe, that there is a way forward on universal suffrage, which will at long last produce a credible chief executive who has the support and respect of the community and who can govern Hong Kong more effectively than at present. So, why have we made no progress? The first point to make is Beijing has moved the goalpost. If you look at Annex 1 of the Basic Law, Annex 1 says, if there is a need to amend the arrangements for electing the chief executive in 2017, or in 2007 at that time, past 2007, then it has to obtain the endorsement of two-thirds of LegCo members, secure the approval of the chief executive, and be reported to the MPC. Notice, reported. No mention that we have to seek the approval of central government. Well, all that was swept away by the interpretation handed down by the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress in 2004, when in one fell swoop, Beijing told Hong Kong people in no uncertain terms, no universal suffrage in 2007, not even in 2012. You will have to wait until 2017 at the earliest to see universal suffrage. And at this point in time, we still cannot see any light at the end of the tunnel. And with that interpretation, Beijing has not only the right to decide on the timing of universal suffrage, but also very much how universal suffrage will be achieved. The second is a total breakdown of trust. You have a government who seems to be increasingly out of touch with community aspirations. Despite the promise of one country, two systems, a high degree of autonomy for Hong Kong people, and Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong, we see blatant and increasing interference from the liaison office, quite contrary to Article 22 of the Basic Law, which lays down very clearly no representative of the central government in Hong Kong, or for that matter, even in the mainland, can interfere in the internal administration of Hong Kong, which is clearly the responsibility of the chief executive and his team. The consequence of this interference is that the people increasingly do not trust that government policies are made with their best interest at heart, forcing people to feel that the only way they can make their voices heard is to take to the streets, and in fact leading to the radicalism that you see now in our LegCo, affecting the good functioning of the Legislative Council, and in its wake, preventing good decisions and bad decisions all not being made. This is clearly not in the overall interest of Hong Kong as a whole. And finally, the lack of progress can be attributed to a total lack of leadership. Where is the government? Why is the government taking a disinterested bystander role in discussing with political parties, with people in Hong Kong, how to move forward on universal suffrage? Why is this task now being taken up by the liaison office? Again, as I pointed out, contrary to the basic law. Not only is there a lack of leadership on political reforms, but you see a government that is frustrated time and again in pushing its programs forward because we have a chief executive who has no political mandate and no political legitimacy to govern. We have a chief executive who makes it increasingly clear in the 2 years that he has been imposed that he doesn't stand on Hong Kong people's side, that he doesn't share our core values, he does not see it as his main priority to implement two systems to safeguard our rights and freedoms and protect the rule of law. Instead, everything he does tells us that he is there to toe Beijing's line. As long as he has the liaison office and Beijing behind him, he is protected because he knows very few of us have the vote. We can't boot him out even if we don't like what he's doing. I've been at this game a long time, in fact, since 1962. And I've been on both sides of the political spectrum. 39 years as a career civil servant, I've been a LegCo member, and now I'm a private citizen who's still involved in politics. So let me tell you, or let me share with you, what I find most frustrating. The first is that you have people who are otherwise quite sensible saying, we don't need democratic government. They hark back to the good old colonial days, when every single member of the legislature and every single member of the government's cabinet was handpicked by the governor, when frequently things probably just went through on the nod. But these people should wake up. Times have changed. LegCo now comprises at least half the members who are directly elected. You have an increasingly sophisticated and educated Hong Kong public, and their aspirations have increased. They expect better of this government, and they know very well what are their rights and freedoms. And this government has to respond to those aspirations. We need to move forward. We need to give credibility to our chief executive, and we need to make it better and easier for the government to govern. Not that I am saying that universal suffrage will solve all our problems. The second thing that I find very frustrating is the refusal of people to see that this whole question of constitutional reforms must be approached on a holistic basis. Now, what do I mean by that? At the moment, there is very little attention being paid to the need to reform the makeup of the Legislative Council and to make changes to the 2016 LegCo elections, particularly in removing functional constituencies because they truly are rotten boroughs. They enable a small vested interest representing no more than 230,000 constituency or electors, and some of them corporate votes, as against 3.5 million people who vote for those in geographical constituencies in direct elections. At the very least, we have to remove corporate votes, remove the arrangement for split voting, which again enables small vested interests to rule the day and overturn the votes of those who enjoy higher popularity amongst the community as a whole. This is the least we should do. And we must also try and improve, to the extent possible, the representativeness of the whole LegCo. If we don't make this move in 2016, then I have to say that the prospect for universal suffrage in the election of all members of the LegCo in 2020 will become increasingly remote. And finally, I have to point out that there are leading members of our community who, because of their own vested interests, have absolutely no qualms about forfeiting their credibility in favor of towing the central government line. Well, I'm glad that at least the issue of the white paper has prompted some, in particularly in our business sector, to sit up and take notice. If there's one thing that the business sector has always been extremely complacent about, and it's been pointed out to me time and again, I often get this, you know, the sort of, you know, puzzled look and say, "Anson, why are you so agitated? Why are you pushing for all these reforms? Hong Kong is still the city that works. We still have the rule of law. We have an independent judiciary. All is well." Okay, is the independence of the judiciary now still protected with the issue of the white paper, which suggests that members of the judiciary must be patriots and that in passing judgments on cases, they have to have regard to national security and national interests? So everybody should sit up and take notice. The fact is that if one country, two systems can be set aside so easily, and the autonomy promised to the people of Hong Kong can be taken away at Beijing's pleasure, not even the rule of law and the independence of the judiciary can be guaranteed. So, along this winding road, where do we go from here? We must all realize that this year is a crunch year for Hong Kong. It is now or never. And I think Hong Kong people have demonstrated through the record turnout, at least for a decade in yesterday's march, and the earlier referendum where nearly 800,000 people participated in voting, even though the three options before them may not have been to their liking. And over 700,000 of those who took part in the vote made it clear that if we are presented with a set of proposals that provide for screening, for no competition, no choice, then our legislature must vote it down. So much for the assertion that some people have made, well, why don't you pocket what we're being offered? More will come later. I think Hong Kong people have demonstrated we want the whole loaf and not half a loaf. And we certainly don't want a loaf that is rotten through and through. I think the way forward is to try and seek consensus. And it's high time that this government come out with a credible set of proposals. The government cannot continue to insist that civil nomination is in breach of the basic law and yet failed to produce any alternatives. My group, Hong Kong 2020, we've put forward a proposal that absolutely contains no reference to civil nomination. We've concentrated on enlarging the representativeness of the nominating committee, and it is fully in conformity with the basic law. And we're not the only group to do this. The public is dizzy with the number of proposals that are currently out there containing various forms of widening the representativeness of the nominating committee. And yet, what does the government do? It only comes out and say, this is not acceptable, that is not acceptable. So what is acceptable? I hope very much that in the light of the people's sentiments that have been demonstrated in the civil referendum and in the march yesterday, that this government and Beijing will listen, will open the negotiating dialogue. Negotiation means there has to be compromise on all sides. But what we have seen so far in the past few months is that the compromise seems to be all have to be on the side of the PAN Democrats. You have the conservative element, DAB, the largest political party in the legislature, coming out with a set of proposals that are totally incredulous and totally unacceptable. Why have they set the threshold for even qualifying for nomination at half the members of the nominating committee? Is this a fair set of election proposals? So I hope this government will, at long last, demonstrate some leadership. When there is such sharply divided public opinion on constitutional reforms, nobody other than the government can try and forge a consensus and bring to the negotiating party all those involved. And I am convinced that whilst at the moment there are those who insist on civil nomination, at the end of the day, what we all want to see is a credible set of proposals that meet minimum criteria, which is there is choice, there is competition, you do not set down unreasonable restrictions over people's right to participate. Let me now, if I have time, I will go on to talk about Hong Kong 2020's proposal, but I do not want to leave without saying a note about the role of the international community. You all know that Martin Lee and I were roundly criticized for going to the States. Well, I have to say to you that we have absolutely no regrets, and recent events have proven us right. Why should the international community sit up and take notice about what is happening in Hong Kong? It is because they have a stake in Hong Kong. They have large investments. They have nationals living here. We have a whole swathe of bilateral agreements entered into with our trading partners. All these agreements are based on the fundamental principle that there will be one country, two systems, and that we will enjoy a high degree of autonomy, and it will be Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong. Let me just quote you a few statistics to demonstrate the extent of international interest. The World Investment Report by the UN Conference on Trade and Development says that Hong Kong is the world's third largest recipient of foreign direct investment. 73 of the world's top 100 banks operate in Hong Kong, and we are home to the world's sixth largest securities market, second largest IPO market, and fifth largest foreign exchange market in the world. Over 100 airlines fly in and out of our airport under the auspices of 67 air services agreements, which we conclude on our own. Hong Kong is the world's fourth largest shipping registry. The SAR is home to 66 foreign consuls general and 73 honorary consuls and over 9,000 overseas companies. It has signed visa waiver agreements with 42 countries, double taxation agreements with 35 countries and regions, legal assistance arrangements with 35 countries, and investment promotion and protection agreements with 17 countries. So, when the international community takes an interest in what goes on in Hong Kong, it is not interference. It is just prudent concern for their own self-interest. I want to point out particularly the United Kingdom's responsibility towards Hong Kong. Yesterday during the march, I had several people coming up saying to me, Mrs. Chen, we really feel sold out by Britain. Where is Britain's voice in the wake of the issue of the white paper? It's hardly necessary for me to point out Britain's legal and moral responsibility towards Hong Kong as a co-signatory to the Joint Declaration. We see the Premier Li Keqiang and David Cameron standing side by side, smiling and signing a whole host of agreements about investment and trade. In this joint statement that both leaders signed, there was barely a mention of Hong Kong, and in very bland terms, and absolutely no reference to the Joint Declaration. Let me recall for you what John Major said in 1996 to the Hong Kong business community when he was trying to instill confidence. He said, Hong Kong will never walk alone. And I quote, Britain would mobilize the international community and pursue every legal and other avenue available to us if China breaches its promises under the Joint Declaration. Is Britain going to honor this promise? I think it remains to be seen. This time round, Hong Kong people will not settle for second best. We want a credible set of proposals. We're not looking for the moon and the sun. We're asking for Beijing to deliver on its promise to the people of Hong Kong. Give us a set of proposals that is not rigged from the start, that only produces the outcome that you wish to see. There's no point in giving us three or four puppets and then telling Hong Kong people, now you exercise one man, one vote, and you go and vote from amongst these three or four. What sort of universal suffrage is that? Finally, we have Beijing officials lamenting the fact that 17 years after the handover, the hearts and minds of Hong Kong people have not returned to the motherland. Well, all I can say is, if their quest at the end of the day is to capture the hearts and minds of Hong Kong people, then they are going about it exactly the wrong way. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Chen. And with that, I'd like to throw open the floor for questions from the audience. Back here first, please. Please identify yourselves.
I'm Steve Vines. Mrs. Chen, can I put to you this thought, which actually I know you're very familiar with, which is that in the current atmosphere, the polarization has reached a level. People are so angry. The demands that you would have heard yesterday on the march are now raising in volume. On the other side of the spectrum, the only form of preparation that I know of that the government's done for the future is to talk about which bigger prison it's going to open to put protesters in. So it seems to me that the people like yourself, respected people like yourself, who represent a compromised position, are being increasingly sidelined and made irrelevant by this determination on one side to deny Hong Kong any form of legitimate universal suffrage, and demands of other people to say, look, we don't care anymore. We are so furious, we're so angry, we want the lot.
Well, I have to say that I agree. I know exactly how Ronnie Tong feels. The fact that he's been through a lot and now he's given up on fighting for his own proposal. But I think now is not the time to give up. I agree. I consider myself an eminently reasonable, sensible person who's always willing to compromise. The question is whether in the minds of Beijing leaders, I'm a person that they feel they can talk to. But their perception of who is acceptable and who is not acceptable is that this person must be manageable. Well, all those who know me must know that I have a mind of my own. But I can also see, I'd like to try and address concerns on both sides. I know that fundamentally, the concern on the part of Beijing is that they don't feel they can trust the people of Hong Kong. But just look at the good sense demonstrated by the students yesterday in their sit-in in Chater Garden. There was no violence. There was no abuse hurled at the police. And this demonstrates time and again the good sense and pragmatism of Hong Kong people. Now, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Why don't you allow us to exercise one man, one vote? We'll elect a leader whom I am sure can work with Beijing, but who at the same time can earn the respect and support of the Hong Kong community simply by being seen to defend one country, two systems, and sharing our core values. I point out time and again, the concept of one country, two systems is not written in tablets of stone. After all, it's never been tried before. But far from successive CEs attempting to see how far this envelope will stretch, you have successive CEs who are more and more willing to toe the Beijing line. And of course, you now see in the white paper that Beijing has decided that they need to crack down even harder on Hong Kong and claw back even on some of the promises that they have made to the people of Hong Kong. But they should realize that if they want to see stability and true harmony in Hong Kong, they need to give the people the right to vote for our leaders. I don't know about other people, but I feel terribly insulted when I am told somehow I'm not eligible to elect my leader. Why not? I can be trusted to elect whom I think will best meet the task. So just trust us. Allow us to do this, and we will demonstrate to you this is the best way of securing long-term stability in Hong Kong, not otherwise.
Thank you. Tara?
Thank you, Mrs. Chen, for your remarks. I'm Tara Joseph with Reuters. In your speech, you say this time Hong Kong will not settle for second best. And there was some discussion of how youth are increasingly involved in protest. Do you think we'll have to see some violence before any of this is resolved? Are you confident it actually can be resolved by discussion and consensus?
Well, I hope very much that wiser counsel will prevail, both with the SAR government and with Beijing. I actually take great encouragement from the behavior and the active participation of our younger generation, led by people like Joshua Wong, Agnes Chow, and the others. I see in them our future political leaders. They are a very different generation from my generation when I was growing up. They're much more prepared to stand up and be counted. They have the courage of their convictions. They can see that if we allow one country, two systems to be eroded, then they have no future. They are fighting for their future. I am not fighting for my generation because I hope and I don't see that things will deteriorate to such an extent that I have to leave Hong Kong for the remaining years of my life. But I am very concerned about my children and my grandchildren. My husband and I have brought up our children with certain core values. These core values are very different from those pertaining in the mainland. I do not wish to see them change their core values and adopt the worst aspects of Communist Party rule in the mainland. And if they feel under threat, and if they feel they have to change their lifestyle, then I would prefer that at this stage, my children provide their children with some other choices so that they are not forced down this road. So it's very much about wanting to preserve our lifestyle and our core values, which are the fundamental planks to one country, two systems. Deng Xiaoping had the vision in the early 1970s to see that this is the best way ensuring long-term stability in Hong Kong and prosperity, and enabling Hong Kong to play a unique role in our country's long-term sustainable growth and modernization. That has not changed, despite the fact that there are many now investing in the mainland.
Francis.
Thank you, Mrs. Chan. Francis Moriarty, I'm freelance. You talk about being a person who's always willing to compromise. And normally in politics, that's a very useful trait. But are we now in a situation where perhaps being willing to compromise is, if I may put it really bluntly, no longer a desirable trait? Are things now at a point where what you laud in Joshua Wong and others, that willingness to be steadfast, that 80% plus of people who cast ballots saying, whatever comes forward, if it doesn't look like democracy and walk and talk like democracy, we don't want it, veto it. Is that not a message that the community, or at least a significant portion of the community, has reached a point where compromise is no longer a plus?
Well, I think compromise is still on the table. The point I want to note is that, yes, there are still people, particularly in the wake of the civil referendum, who insist on civil nomination. But the fact that the True Alliance's three-track proposal won the day, and the three-track proposal is civil nomination, civil recommendation, and nomination by the nominating committee. And the Alliance for True Democracy has made it plain. They are not insisting that all three strands have to be there. So that the message I get from that is that, okay, if the first two are out, or the first one is out, let's look at the composition of the nominating committee. It doesn't rule it out. And I still believe that a compromise is possible. A compromise does not mean that we will forego the basic principles of fair, open election. I pointed out to you the three minimum criteria. We just want a set of proposals that does not allow Beijing to manipulate and dictate who is going to be the chief executive. And on that score, I continue to believe, and my fellow colleagues in Hong Kong 2020 believe, that we need to work hard. So in the coming months, what we will do is to explain our proposals in greater detail, and in particular, explain the voting method. I think at the end of the day, at this juncture, it's not about ownership of any particular model. It is about all those who want to see a solution coming together, trying to find common ground, and seeing whether on the basis of those common ground, we can fetch up, at least with some basic principles, which we will use as a point of negotiation with Beijing and with central and with the Hong Kong government here.
Angie?
Thank you, Mrs. Chan. Angie Lau, Bloomberg. We had the pleasure of speaking with each other this morning on the air. I wish that I had so much more time with you. This is something I wanted to ask, didn't have time and have the opportunity to now. Do you think that one country, two systems is a transition for Hong Kong to ultimately adapt to China, or is it an opportunity for China to understand a broader system beyond communism? And my second question is, what do you think China's long game is, and is it inevitable?
Well, I like to think that when Deng Xiaoping crafted One Country, Two Systems, that he was rather hoping that during those 50 years, that somehow China will catch up, that there will start to develop in mainland China a system that will progressively close the gap between the two systems and moving more towards the Hong Kong system. Unfortunately, at the moment, that does not seem to be the stance of Beijing. Now, what is China's long-term objective for Hong Kong? It is a pity that the moderate voice, and there is a moderate voice in Beijing, even amongst the leadership, but we all see that at the moment, the diehards and the conservative element is winning the day. But it's interesting that in recent months, you get more people in Guangzhou, in Macau, and people coming from the mainland saying how important it is for Hong Kong to keep up the fight, because it is only by keeping up the fight that they in the mainland will eventually maybe get a taste of some of the freedoms that we currently enjoy in Hong Kong. But I think it's also very much up to the international community to demonstrate and to send this message to China that it's not about economic might. At the end of the day, whether a country is truly a member of the international community must involve some embrace of universal values, rights and freedoms, and human dignity. It is about how a country's leaders treat its own people. A country that spends more on internal security than it does on external defense can never, in my mind, truly be accepted as a member of the international community. I consider myself every bit a patriot. I may not be manageable, but I want to see my country become strong. And my definition of what is a strong country is the way you treat your own people, particularly the less advantaged, privileged members of the community. The leadership in Beijing, after four decades of phenomenal economic growth, the fact that it is now the world's second largest economy, surely it is time that they start to have more confidence in their own ability and more trust in their own people, including the people of Hong Kong.
Thank you. Maybe from the audience, another question here, please. Here's the microphone.
My name is Kevin. I have a question, among your speech, right? Your PD, you believe, the China government from Beijing will honor the one country, two systems. But what if they don't honor it? They don't care. I mean, look at the geopolitical environment now. The Chinese have no friends in absolute, maybe North Korea, right? And, they don't care. I mean, if you look at Chinese history, right? Look at Chairman Xi Jinping, right? And now they are, I'm the rule. I'm the ruler. I'm making new sets of rules or games. I'm playing this game my way. I mean, if they don't care. I mean, this happened in the Chinese history, thousand years ago, right? And keep on going. I mean, repeating the same, look at Qing Dynasty, they don't care. They don't care. They just don't care. I mean, this one country, two systems is genius, maybe from Deng Xiaoping. But now Deng Xiaoping has died 10 years ago, right? More than 10 years. But now the new leader said, maybe I don't care. So what can we do?
Well, some people point out that the China of today is still the Middle Kingdom, despite the fact that it's undergone such phenomenal economic transformation. But I think we have to have hope in, if not the current leadership, then future leadership, because China is no longer insulated, it no longer is a closed-door country. Its people see more of the world. There is the influence of social media. More of its people are going overseas to be educated. But it's also important, I think, for us in Hong Kong to continue to stand up and be counted. And it's important for the international community to reinforce and to restate their core values. It's not that they want to interfere in the internal affairs of China. But what happens to a China that contains one-fifth of the world's population? Its core values, its behavior towards other countries matter just as much to all countries on this planet. And so we all have to keep on reinforcing those core values and pointing out that whilst democracy is not a panacea for all ills, it is still, until human ingenuity can produce another system, it is still the best system for ensuring maximum community participation, a transparent, accountable government, and a government that is seen to be responsive to community expectations. So we must continue to have hope, and I have not given up hope on my country.
With that, we have time for one more question. Do we have anybody on the veranda whom I'm maybe not seeing? Okay, and one more over here then.
Hi, Madam Chan. It's Anthony Kuhn with NPR. You mentioned the role of the Chinese liaison officials here. Some of my colleagues have been writing about their, underground status here in the territory. What do you think they are really doing to affect politics here? What do you think is going on behind the scenes? Maybe we can only speculate. And how can their role be normalized? Thank you.
Normalization, it depends on what you mean by normalization. We all know that the Communist Party, at least the underground Communist Party, exists in Hong Kong, and today it seems to be thriving. The liaison office, with its network of people and its contacts, and the fact that it has unlimited resources, is increasingly infiltrating into every level of Hong Kong society. The media, NGOs, they influence political parties to the extent that they can get away with it. They certainly have infiltrated into the civil service. Money is plentiful, and unfortunately, money talks. So if this continues, sooner or later, two systems will cease to exist. You don't have to wait until 2047. Is that really in the best interest of China as a whole? And how is the rest of the world going to, you know, react? The rest of the world should pay attention to how Hong Kong is being treated by China in terms of its international treaty obligations under the Joint Declaration. If China can willy-nilly walk away from these promises, what does it say about China's commitment to the rest of the world as regards the treaty obligations that they have with other countries? Earlier on, I pointed out that we have a whole raft of bilateral agreements with the rest of the world. These are based on faithful implementation of one country, two systems. If two systems go, then Hong Kong is increasingly unable to honor our treaty obligation to the countries with whom we have concluded these agreements.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Chan, for coming today. We do appreciate it. Thank you. We always like to... Thank you very much.